Well, welcome to the roundtable, Indigenous and Layman Identities in the 20th Century. I'd like to begin by acknowledging that we're meeting on the traditional homelands of the Ute, Paiute, Goshute, and Shoshone peoples. And I make that recognition not as an elegy to bygone people, but in recognition of living people who continue to reside in this territory and in this room, and who enact reserved treaty rights in these territories. My name's Stan Thane. I'm a visiting assistant professor of anthropology and religion at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. And it's an honor to be invited to introduce the panelists today and to moderate the panel. And thanks to Farina for organizing it, for all of her hard work, not just in this session, but for the entire conference over multiple years, and for making MHA such a great, a lot of the diversity that does exist in MHA is a lot of that's worth due to the hard work of Farina and others. I'm going to introduce people in order that they appear here, or in the order they'll be presenting. That's right. So Farina King is Biligana, born for Kia'ani, the Towering House clan of the Diné, or Navajo. Her maternal grandmother was Euro-American, and her paternal grandfather was Sinajini, Black-Streaked Woods People clan of the Diné. Thus, she is a Diné woman and a citizen of the Navajo Nation. She is currently an assistant professor of history and an affiliate of the Cherokee and Indigenous Studies Department at Northeastern State University in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. She received her U.S. History PhD at Arizona State University, and she is the author of Earth Memory Compass, Diné Landscapes and Education in the 20th Century, which the University Press of Kansas published in 2018. And as I pointed out, she's done a lot of work as a member of the board of MHA this year, and she's currently working on a memoir about Navajo Mormons in the 20th century. Forrest Kutch is unfortunately not able to join with us today. M. Kalei Kim will follow Farina. She's an experienced educator who has worked extensively in education management. She received her BA for double majors in anthropology and English with creative writing at Stanford University. She attended Kamehameha schools in Hawaii. She was primarily raised on Molokai, learning native Hawaiian language, culture, and traditions from an early age. Kalei Kim has been an independent family historian, developing workshops and different approaches to facilitate and develop family history studies and work especially for indigenous communities of the Americas and Polynesia. Her research in family history has enabled her to explore and examine various sources from indigenous Mormon perspectives. Following Kalei, we'll hear from Caleb Miner. Right here. Sorry.
Stand so you can see
Caleb. Caleb Miner is a PhD student in history at the University of Oklahoma with a focus on indigenous North American history and Mormon history. He received his MA in history from Missouri State University. He researches how various indigenous peoples across North America have reinvented themselves as Christians, both within the Mormon faith and among other Christian denominations. He studies early Mormonism and its interaction with Native Americans. Among his current projects, he is researching how indigenous people have encountered and altered Christianity throughout North America, how they have done the same within Mormonism specifically, and how they have altered Mormon thought over time. Following Caleb's presentation, we'll then hear from Elisa Eastwood Pulido. Elisa received her PhD in religious studies, focusing on religions of North America at Claremont Graduate University. She holds an MFA in writing from the School of Art Institution of Chicago and a BA in German from Brigham Young University. Her research interests include religion in Latin America, religious myths of origin, and the indigenization of Mormonism. She's also a poet and has published in literary journals in the US and the UK. She has been an adjunct professor of world religions at Brigham Young University in Salt Lake City. Elisa has several recent and forthcoming publications, including her book, The Spiritual Evolution of Margarito Bautista, Mexican Mormon Evangelizer, Polygamous Dissident, and Utopian Father. And finally, our final presenter and discussant is Robert Joseph. Robert Joseph is Maori from New Zealand and earned a PhD in law from Waikato University. He is a notified barrister and solicitor of the High Court of New Zealand, a senior law academic at the law school, and a director of the Maori Indigenous Governance Center. I'm going to skip the pronunciations rather than butcher them. Sorry. And the Canada-New Zealand Studies Center at Waikato University. Some of his ancestors joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in 1884, and he has written and published on Maori and the Church. Dr. Joseph has served as the New Zealand Church History Advisor, and he is also a registered researcher and historian for the Waitangi Tribunal and the Crown Forestry Rental Trust for addressing historic and contemporary breaches of the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand. And I've seen the longer CV of Robert Joseph. It's a truly impressive body of work that he's done. I'm really looking forward to this panel. Each of the panelists will take about 8 to 10 minutes. I failed to go over this earlier, so I will hold up a 3-minute and a 1-minute sign. And after that, I'll give you the not so nice sign. And if you keep going, I probably won't jump up and stop you. But
me.
Yeah. All right, so with no further ado, I'll turn it over to Farina.
Thank you all for coming. It is an honor and a privilege to have these opportunities for these kind of conversations where I've had my friends, my colleagues, gathering together from very far places who have sacrificed much to have a very valuable conversation. And it means a lot to have you listen and to carry with you, in that sense, you know, the knowledge that you're gaining from the stories, from the histories that we are sharing from wherever we're coming from. And I'm grateful to Stan for coming as well, a great distance to help moderate and to attempt to introduce me in Dine Bazad, you know, to try the best he can to acknowledge me, because in a traditional way, actually, Navajos would be introduced by someone else. And now we often introduce ourselves in our language, but it means a lot when someone else can introduce us. That is an honor, and it's much respected to hear people who recognize us by our clans and our kinship, our relations. And so I want to say yat e, and Darren, I might mess this up. Eh? Is that right? Okay. I did mess it up. I'm trying to learn different. So that's is hello in Shoshone. And my experiences of learning and meeting different peoples from, you know, Aloha country to Maori country to Mexico and all the many indigenous peoples there, and Oklahoma, where I am now, and Salagi country, CO to Oklahomans there. It's really influenced me. And why I want to begin with my part explaining the inspiration and motivation behind this panel and organizing it is that there's so much value and significance in having conversations from all over the world, different voices who identify with histories of settler colonialism with the church and their relationship, have been identified as indigenous, native, and Lamanite, and how, because of the way peoples have labeled us and a the appropriations and the way different peoples have identified themselves, it brings us together to find common grounds. And so with this recent book, Essays on American Indians and Mormons, that we have a book signing, I'm going to just be unabashedly open about that and share that with you right after this panel. My article in that was about Native Hawaiians and Navajos and the relationships that they developed, because Native Hawaiians were, and not just Native Hawaiians, actually many peoples who identified as indigenous, or they identified as Lamanite, or they were called that, they were often called to the Navajo Nation. And so that article is very much influenced my thoughts with this and other projects that I'm now getting into, gearing up for since my first book came out, The Earth Memory Compass, which is very important as well to my understandings of Mormon studies, the way that I'm grappling with it, trying to understand it. So Gamali Do Dene means being Navajo and Mormon. And I mean, now we know Mormon's maybe not the kosher, it's not the kosher term in the church, different discussions about that, but Navajos would say Gamali. And maybe I'm even learning that pronunciation. And in a lot of these conversations we're having, positionality matters. For me, as someone who is trained historian, PhD, academic, I do appreciate all the different people who have influenced me and my work, and how we're learning to continue to communicate, be accessible, have different conversations. So I'm also honored and very privileged by not only the influences of many indigenous and native peoples in this very region who are in this room, who have shaped me from Shoshone communities, whether from Ute or Dene, who have moved up to this region, and others, many others, and as well as my friends and colleagues here, they all come from such different backgrounds too. And that's wonderful to help us think about the different approaches, and whether it's having an eye for legal studies or more an ethnographic approach, or family history and how they've shaped me in different ways. And my elders, I would not be here if it were not for them, such as pictured here, my Uncle Albert, who really helped me, someone who is of mixed ancestry, was raised primarily by my Anglo-American mother. That's what Bilagana means and refers to, is that Anglo-American, that I recognize I come from the privilege and the entanglements of settler colonialism. I embody that. And many of us do, whether we're conscious of it or not. I don't like to say all of us, but we can all think about how we personally are connected to this. So whether you think, oh, you know, how does this conversation relate to me, whether you're conscious of it or not, I hope that this conversation we're having, that's why I really like the roundtable format, because I see it as more a direct conversation with you all, and I hope it continues through, you know, the publications we do, possibly more workshops, more collaborations and connections that we make here, that you all realize how this kind of work is significant to you in whatever field you are, and that you're on lands that have been shaped and influenced by indigenous peoples, peoples who have claimed, who, as I love Tacy Atsidi just said it in the last panel, the land has claimed them. It's an integral part of who they are and their identity. So for me, you know, growing up on the Navajo reservation where I was born, but primarily relocated with my family to the DC area. This is an image of my dad. His story has really shaped my conceptualization of my identity, of course, because it's through my father's relations that I'm born for the Kia'ani and Sinajini of Dene, of the Navajo Nation. And Navajo is very matrilineal as well. So, of course, I recognize, as I have here, that I am Bilagana as well. So I also have this complicated, I'm Bilagana, I'm Dene, and then On top of that all, my parents converted to the church before I was born and raised me in the church. So a lot of the work I do, I have to come at it from this positionality of it. I'm very interconnected and it's personal on a level. And that's very difficult in academia when you're pushed to be as objective as possible, to get outside yourself. But I hope and value also trying to show how this kind of autoethnographic work, memoir, collective biography, or biography, they are significant as well to helping people understand, you know, what does it mean when you are a part of these communities that you're working with, especially as a historian, and people will talk back to you, and you can be banished from your family if you get them angry. It's like a whole nother sense of accountability that I have not only in Mormon studies, but also in my studies of Native American history, that I live with that kind of accountability and responsibility to have. So here's an image of my father when he was on his mission. His story is one that has connected me to BYU, to a lot of Mormon studies, and trying to understand, you know, what were all these dynamics, especially when he was coming of age in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and we had this plaque in my house that my dad received from George P. Lee that said, you know, congratulated him for supporting the Lamanite cause. And what does this mean, Lamanite cause? And this is what I grew up with, kind of hearing stories about, and even being called a Lamanite by people, and then meeting other people who would refer to, I went to the Lamanite ward, and they're of different tribal nations, different backgrounds. That's how I met Kalei, to be honest, is in a Native American ward, and the relations we have, and why my name is Farina Noelani King. You know, even questions like that. I grew up with this, that even the way that I was named, that I write about in this article in the book that's just come out, Essays on American Indians and Mormons, is that Native Hawaiians who went on their missions, they would come back to Navajo Nation. Some intermarried with Navajos, and they worked in education, Navajo education. So there was a strong influence of the church growing on the Navajo Nation, thanks to these kind of interconnections between peoples who identified or related to the Book of Mormon in different ways, or were identified as Lamanites, which groups such as, I'll skip here, the Lamanite generation that formed at BYU, I think that really embodies it. Let me find if I can get to that. You know, when there's all these programs like the Indian Student Placement Program, then at BYU, this presence of Natives and community, and this image here, Lamanite generation, that initially was primarily Native American, as you can see in these images, but later would expand and include Polynesians and Latin Americans. And my extensive work with oral histories then connected me to peoples from different nations, different groups of sovereignties, who would, in one way or another, be put to the question of, do you think you're Lamanite or not? And how do they relate to that? So for me, I don't want to take much of the time. I'm going to pass it over. But I wanted to open up where I'm coming from with this work, how I organize this session, and I hope the conversations we will delve into about what happens to groups who are called Lamanite, their experiences, where they're coming from. And this is much a developing work in progress, because it's still a lot of processing. There's so many, you know, different branches and stories with it. But what do these different comparisons and shared experiences mean for, and what groups, you know, define these are the Lamanites, these are not? So I will wrap up there, but I hope this is more like a launching and planting seeds of ongoing conversations and work on this. So, yeah.
Sure. Okay, I'm going to start, and then we'll catch up there. And I want to thank Farina for asking me to be on this panel. For the last 7, 8 years, my life has been an exercise in deep listening I did my dissertation then. It's been written into a book that'll be coming out from Oxford on the life of Margarito Bautista. He left more indigenous writings than probably anybody I know of so far. A 564-page tome, 16 years of diaries, letters, scores of pamphlets. And so even though I am not indigenous myself, it's been my great privilege to listen to an indigenous theologian from the church who wrote so very much, and I try to present his thought and his words today. So my talk here, I'm going to be talking about defrancismo and Lamanite identity formation. I'll explain that in a minute. You want me to do this? Okay. So this is a picture of Margarito Bautista, and my argument is going to be that his combinative religious thought originated in his Nahua roots, and that the practice of the Nahua poetic and philosophical device known today as defrancismo allowed him to form an identity around disparate aspects of his life, such as his Mexicanidad and his Mormonism, while making sense of the whole. Though Bautista probably was not familiar with the term, he would have been familiar with the usage of defrancismo. He was born in Atlautla in the state of Mexico to Petra Candelaria Bautista, who was pure Nahua and spoke only Nahuatl. So the term defrancismo, the term defrancismo was first used by Mexican priest and scholar Angel Maria Garibay to describe a Nahua literary device which couples two elements in order to present a third while still preserving the individual differences of the original elements. To call, for example, the body, hand and feet, is to conceive of the body by its parts by synecdoche. Okay, and defrancismo can also align parallel concepts or seemingly unrelated ideas under a single heading, as we see some of those here. Luis León, scholar of religion in the Americas, has written that defrancismo, which he calls also duality and dissonance, was at the religious philosophical base of the Nahuas, and that the term can also be said to describe the philosophical quest for explanation. León writes, "When the spiritual answers of the day do not answer the confusion, pain, and agonies of people on the margins of power, then new explanations are sought through defrancismo or spiritual poetics." According to Patricia N. Montilla, in defrancismo, a larger truth emerges, illuminating the hidden mysteries of paired but separate realities which dance interdependently and in grand cooperation with each other. In this definition, defrancismo represents the resolution of dualities, the reconciliation of paradox. She goes on to say that defrancismo breaks the binaries and invites us to think in new ways that give birth to new forms of understanding the world. So a couple of examples of defrancismo can be seen in the Aztec practices of sometimes adopting the gods of conquered tribes into the Aztec cosmology, the apparition of the Virgin of Guadalupe to Juan Diego at the site of worship for Tonantzin, the Aztec goddess of fertility, and Bautista comparing Huitzilopochtli to passages found in Malachi in a Mexican branch sacrament meeting. So anyway, you have racial theories that rely on defrancismo also abounding. Chicano poet Alfred Arteaga sees defrancismo as continuing in the mestizaje of the Mexican race, where Chicano subjects are both mestizo and Indian and live in the United States or Aztlan. They speak English and or Spanish. As in the literary usage of defrancismo, Arteaga's broad cultural defrancismo yokes elements together while simultaneously keeping those elements separate from the new concepts created by hybridization. Quote, "It is not quite dialectic or metaphor. It is a sign of hybridizing, of leaving bare the work of coming to be. This phrase particularly resonates with what I know of Bautista's thought. The incongruencies between his Mexicanidad and his Mormonism, or his being a Lamanite, were left bare, were part of the work of Mexicans coming to understand what they had lost through colonization and becoming what they were always destined to be. Because of his pre-1960s insistence on the restoration of indigenous lands and his championing of indigenous rights, Bautista has been called a proto-Chicano. His racial theory differs nevertheless from that of Gloria Anzaldúa, who argued that the new mestiza was superior to others precisely because she was racially mixed. Anzaldúa's racial theorizing builds on that of Bautista's contemporary, José Vasconcelos, who argued in 1925 that the cosmic race would arise through miscegenation. Bautista, however, lauded only the indigenous ancestry of the Mexicans. When Amenteni proselytized Bautista to Mormonism in 1901, Bautista found a compelling relationship between the Book of Mormon and his Aztec heritage. According to Tenney's teaching, Bautista was a Lamanite, an indigenous American who had descended from the loins of Abraham. Indigenous Americans or Lamanites were Israelites, and in Bautista's mind, exactly this made them exceptional. They belonged to God's chosen because of their indigenous blood, not because of any European ancestry. In 1901, Bautista was unconcerned about DNA evidence and differing more academic views on the history of Mexico. Though not highly educated, he was highly intelligent and spent many years contemplating his origins. He wrote his own personal De Fracismo, a 564-page tome entitled The Evolution of Mexico, Its True Progenitors and Its Origins, The Destiny of America and Europe, a melding of the history of Mexico with the Book of Mormon. It was published in 1935. For Bautista, the term Lamanite was a complex, multifaceted identity. According to Bautista, Mexicans descended from Nephites, Lamanites, Mulekites, Jacobites, and Josephites, and Zoramites, and were therefore also descendants of Ephraim, Manasseh, and Judah, and therefore also of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Over the course of hundreds of pages, Bautista laid out the facets of Mexican identity as he saw them. Mexicans were indigenous, Aztec, Nahua, and Chichimeca, as well as Mayan and Toltec. The average indigenous Mexican was marginalized, poor, and likely a laborer at home or abroad. Interestingly, Bautista believed that Lamanites could participate in their own diphrastic identity making and thereby influence their future. According to the Book of Mormon, the Gentile church was to use their resources in the development of the indigenous peoples of the Americas. As Bautista saw insufficient movement toward this end, he fomented a schism known as the Third Convention in the LDS Church in Mexico in 1936, for which he was excommunicated in 1937. Despite his excommunication, he continued to believe in the prophetic destiny of Mexicans. The Book of Mormon promised the Lamanites would blossom as the rose, build the New Jerusalem, and usher in the millennium. In the absence of the support of a white Gentile hierarchy, Bautista argued that Mexicans could achieve their millennial role, not just Mexicans, indigenous Americans, through commandment keeping. Obedience itself would help Mexicans prosper in the land. For Bautista, not only was the term Lamanite multifaceted, but the term Mormon was also fraught with nuance and complexity. I think I'm one down. So, as a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, he was simultaneously a missionary, a priesthood bearer, and a congregational leader. Later, he became a conventionist, then an excommunicant, an outcast, a polygamist, and finally a utopian founder. In 1951, Bautista was arrested for swindle, fraud, adultery, deception, and the rape of a young girl. Before dismissing the charges, a Mexican judge asked Bautista if he were a Mormon. Despite his status as an excommunicant, despite his fundamentalism, despite his racial quarrels with the mainstream church over his pro-indigenous hermeneutic of the Book of Mormon, Bautista, after a moment of thought, responded, yes. He gave no explanation for his response. We can only surmise that despite his lack of standing in the mainstream church, the Lamanite/Mexican exceptionalism he taught was based on a lifelong belief in Mormon scripture and the revelations of Joseph Smith. To be a Lamanite required that he believe in things Mormon, and so he was a Mormon. He did not back away from this identifier, though J. Reuben Clark had challenged the millennial roles of Lamanites, though the Gentile white church had claimed an Israelite heritage through Ephraim and relegated indigenous converts into a secondary status believed to be held by descendants of Manasseh, though Mexican mission president Harold W. Pratt had advised members not to read his tome, or though he had been excommunicated for his role in the Third Convention. In summary, although the term Lamanite first came to Bautista from white missionaries, he appropriated the term and made it his own. DiFrancisco allowed him to create a space in which, if not to resolve, at least to accept the dissonance and dualities of his Mexican Lamanite identity. In seeking explanation, Bautista discovered his own explanations and chose his own narratives, and it was exactly at the intersection of his Mexicanidad and his Mormonism that his Nahua heritage allowed him to break the binaries and create a new way of understanding himself and his people.
Hello, everybody. As was mentioned, my name's Caleb Miner. I'm from the University of Oklahoma, working on my PhD right now. Apologies if I'm having trouble projecting. As luck would have it, the week before this conference, I was in an accident, and I just had my first surgery in my mouth, which has been great right before a conference. So I'll do my best. Thank you. Really close? Okay. And thank you to Farina. This has turned into a project that has been very difficult that I thought would not be. And as she well knows, she's helped me out quite a bit, so thank you for that. So what I typically work on, mostly early 19th century indigenous and Mormon history. However, as this project has evolved, it's covered much more time and space, and I'm looking at how Mormon thought regarding Lamanites has changed over time, and especially focusing on how indigenous people themselves, either directly or by being interacted with, has caused that thought process to be altered. And as I started talking about this project to, as I mentioned, I'm from Oklahoma, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who were indigenous came to me and basically wanted their story to be told. They felt that that needed to be spoken about more, about this identity issue. So I have started, and it is in its infancy, but I have started a semi-separate project where I've been interviewing indigenous active members of the church, right now just in Oklahoma. And the overarching questions have been, first of all, is it possible to be indigenous in your identity and still be a Lamanite, or is there something that has to be given up in doing that as people become members of the church? So right now I've interviewed a range of people from various parts of the United States. One of the indigenous people that came asking that they could participate is actually from an indigenous person from Peru. So it's growing very quickly. So for the sake of time, so we have plenty of time to discuss and everything, I'll just go over the high points and the commonalities that have been presented thus far in these interviews. And first of all, in regards to the question of, is it possible to be both Lamanite, if you will, as they're identified by the church, is it possible to maintain an indigenous identity as well as be a Lamanite? And for most, well, all but one of the people that I interviewed, they felt that the answer was much more complicated than a yes or no. In fact, those who spoke quite a bit about it, and my yes came from my Peruvian interviewee who did have a little bit of trouble with English, so her shortened answer was probably partially as a result from that. But they felt that their indigenous identity, not only could they be indigenous and Lamanite, if you will, but it was key to their identity as a Lamanite. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on that on the Lamanite side. But for them, for these interviewees, for these active members of the church that are indigenous, being indigenous, understanding their traditions, understanding their culture was the foundation of their faith. And they felt very proud to be not termed as Lamanites, but identified as this chosen people from the Book of Mormon. As was mentioned, there are other terms that are preferred, such as the seed of Lehi, especially apparently in South America, I was told. But that is quickly becoming the case, it seems, based on these few interviews with North American indigenous people as well. And for these people, understanding their indigeneity, understanding their culture, their stories, for many of them, is what made them join the church in the first place. And I won't go into detail of that right now, but it was quite interesting and surprising, and almost all the interviewees said the same thing in that regard. Not only that, but in regards to the identity as Lamanites, and again, I already mentioned that they don't necessarily prefer that term, as they said. However, they make a very marked distinction between Lamanites and modern indigenous people. So, of course, first and foremost, they prefer to be identified as whatever indigenous group they are from. That is exceptionally important to them, even within their membership in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. However, while they do not like the term, or most of them did not prefer the term of being called, they also noticed that in their experience, that the church, the people in the church, have very much moved away from that terminology to identify indigenous people in general. Now, this is just their experience. It'll take more work to see if that's true. But they also feel that I just had a brain fart here, I'm sorry. Also, we talked about the idea of being righteous and white, as has been termed in LDS ideology. And this goes back to their idea of not being called Lamanites. Why? Because to many of these people, the very term Lamanite, even though they may accept that they are possibly descendants of those people, the term has so much more baggage that goes with it. It has an idea of unrighteousness, of slothfulness, of savagery. And they don't feel that that's what identifies them, and it never has identified their people. So again, to reiterate, they do not like that term. In regards to how the church, both unofficially and officially, has in the past talked about indigenous people, I actually found that almost all of these people that I interviewed were exceptionally forgiving of the church. They either took one of two stances, which was either those people just made mistakes. They were wrong. They were mistaken. And we move forward from that. Or that there was a reason they did it. We don't understand it, but that's the way it is. Okay? And most importantly, I have felt like in this, as I've started this part of the project, is indigenous members of the church want to talk about these issues. They want to have a conversation about their experience within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They want to talk about how they feel with this identity, even if they accept it or reject it entirely. And I believe moving forward on this project, which I definitely will do so, that and I would encourage anyone that is remotely interested to find a way to participate in this type of project. I was just made aware of some work that's being done in regards to oral histories with Indigenous members of the church. And I've got a lot more, but for the sake of time and discussion, I'll go ahead and end there. So thank you very much.
A tēnā koutou katoa e ngā rangatiro ngā hau e whā, kanui te mea tu ki a koutou, he mihi ki te atu e whakakoroore a tōne ingoa, a he mihi ki te kingi Māori a tū heitia, kei te mihi ki aia o tira me tono wharekāhu i āriki nui toru, pai marire ki a rātou, pai marire ki a tātou. Ngā mate ngai tua, o tātou, haere atu rai ngā hunga ora, kanui te mihi, kanui te mihi ki ngā mana whenua, o tēnei rohe, o te pātote, pai ute, go shoot, Navajo, Shoshone, Zuni, me ngā tangata o tēnei whenua. Good afternoon, brothers and sisters. It's an honour for me to present to you in this Mormon History Association conference. I had to do our cultural protocols before we start. I might add they were doing my presentation there, so that timing didn't count for that. So we'll start now. I'm also sort of conscious of time, and also that this is the graveyard shift, and a lot of you look tired.
I know.
And so I'll try and go through this quick, but I'm going to try and give you a little overview of Māori in New Zealand and the whole Lamanite discourse. And I've just got pictures, so I'll go real fast. And actually, I acknowledge the manawahine, we call it, especially the woman who presented here. Manawahine, we call that woman power. Yeah. It's a fine example from, and also my rangatira mate here, Caleb. So for Māori. Okay, there might be a tohu, there might be a sign. Let's just go into it.
Yeah.
If I could show it, I have a... That's the wrong one. I'll be showing a map of the Pacific Ocean.
Uh-huh.
Okay, there we go. Okay, here's the main issues for us as Māori. When we look at the whole Lamanite label, it's talking about identity politics. Who am I and who are we as a collective? What I'll say about identity politics... As it's situational, context-specific, contested, it adapts, evolves in time and space, but it's fundamentally political, not ethnic. It's political. How we define ourselves, so these identity labels, they shift in time and space, as we have seen with the term Lamanite in the church. And actually, for genealogy, our identity is fundamentally built around genealogy and context. But I'll just do this real quick. In the scriptures, it says that Māori Polynesians, I guess the Lamanites, the people referred to here in this presentation, they come from Adam and Eve, so they're children of God at one point. Then at the fall, they became natural men and women. Come down to Noah, come through Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and the genealogy talks about if they were Ham, they're Egyptians. Shem, they're Israel. Japheth, they're Gentiles. If we had time, I'd go through the genealogy to say that from Shem, which is the Israelite line, Shem, Arphaxad, Sala, Heba, that's where the Hebrew label comes from. So they're all Hebrews as well. Come through Abraham, the Abrahamic. Come to Jacob or Isaac, they're Isaac's sons. Through Jacob, they're the house of Israel or the house of Jacob and so on. We come to Judah, there's the Jews, hardly say they come from there, but also through Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, through Lehi and Ishmael, they go to those lines. Then they become Nephites and Lamanites, and through Hagoth, Polynesians. So it's very confusing. Who are we? Right? I just say this with this map. According to Māori oral accounts, our people come from the east, from the eastern Pacific. That's in our oral accounts. I might add, too, that's not just those of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, too. We actually have a marae, a longhouse in New Zealand, where they've got a map on the wall of all the stars that Kalei mentioned, how we followed the stars. And they say we come from North America, then they say we came from Israel, and this is a non-member area too, but they're the experts in our history, our genealogy, as well as astronomy, and that's what a lot of Māori say, not just in the Mormon Church. Oh, we can't say Mormon now, but even when you look at that term Mormon, that's a shift in identity too, right? Not Mormon now, we're Latter-day Saints. But we say we come from there. Incidentally, I've just come from Oklahoma, so I'm grateful to be part of this. I just kind of slid in, luckily, through Farina. I was contacting you, but while I was over there, we're doing some international indigenous trade with indigenous groups up in North America, the US and Canada. But I was mentioning to them that up in this area in Asia, in Taiwan, the Taiwanese, or the indigenous Taiwanese people, believe that Māori and Polynesians come from them. And as a result of that, we've entered into a free trade agreement with them up there. Now, in terms of tying that in, I say that's where Lehi and them were sort of coming around this area, then they came then down, right? How long did it take? 300 odd days? Who knows? So our identity as Lamanites, let me come to it. Oh, we acknowledge Maui. He comes all the way throughout the Pacific with us. We won't go into that. We haven't got time. I'll just say this for our people. Genealogy is critical for our identity. We first go back to our genealogy, and our people are great genealogists. In fact, we have genealogy going all the way back to the gods. And our traditions, I have to mention this one. This is one of our early church leaders. His sons joined the church in Nuhaka. This is where the Whanga family comes from. But I just wanted to show you his moko. His tamoko, his tattoo. It's not just aesthetic. Every line meant something. And these lines on his forehead, on the left side are his mother's genealogy, and on the right side are his father's genealogy. And so we wear our identity. It is with us, we carry it with us. And quickly, the importance of our identity, it's relational. It's we call relational, it's positional, right? So where we are, we believe our traditional legal system is based on relationships. First, relationships with God above. Second, with relationships to the land. You know, like in the biblical account, our creationary accounts are similar, very similar actually, to the pearl of great price. And we're doing a lot of research on that. But we talk about the first woman came from the soil and then from the gods. And so we literally say we're people of the land, we're the tangata whenua. That's our relationship there. With our past, our ancestors, tupuna. Okay. I better take my watch off. Tupuna and Māori, our language is richer. Okay, three. We got 3 hours. 3 minutes. Tupuna in Māori, tu means to stand and puna means spring. So it's richer than ancestor. Tupuna is the spring that give us understanding, that give us life, right? That give us standing in life. That's how we view ancestor, not just ancestor, right? In terms of our present children, the word in Māori for child is tamariki. Tamariki, literally broken down, is child of God. And mokopuna, you know, I mentioned puna is spring, moko is the tattoos. Moko is actually reflection. Right? And so mokopuna, or our grandchildren, are a reflection of our spring. Right? That's where we view our grandchildren. And so the good test of parenting is in your grandchildren, because your children will mirror what you do, right? As parents, but our grandchildren are a reflection of us. But what all these words mean, and whānau, hapū, these are family, sub-tribe, tribe, so what they imply in our legal system is all based on relationships. Our identity is based on relationships, right? With God, with the land, with our people, with our past, present, future, and so on. Okay, really quick. Now, worldview was pushed into a state of perilous imbalance when the English came, and they told us we had a new identity. We were savages and barbarians and uncivilized. And then they tried to impose that on us, and we fought them over it. But then you had Samuel Marsden come along in 1814. Here's what he said about Māori. I'll give you 10 seconds to read that. But he said, actually, they were, for the savages that they have seen, they were well prepared to hear the knowledge of Christianity more than any savage nation had seen. That was in 1808, came in 1814, and Christianity took a while after a few wars, but it blossomed within Māoridom because it had a familiar spirit to us. We understood it, and we could locate ourselves in it. Māori believed, even while they were there, that we were of the House of Israel. Okay, I'm finishing. I just say this, 1881, they first went to the Anglicans, Anglican Church, then the Catholic Church, then the Methodists, after we fought them in the New Zealand Wars. Then Joseph F. Smith, who served in Hawaii, and he could kōrero Hawaiian, understood the tikanga and everything. He said, by revelation, it's now time to take the gospel to Māori. Once he did, the church flourished amongst Māori because it had a familiar spirit to us, everything, and actually we located ourselves in the discourse. And interestingly, there was a shift in some of the missionaries' identities too. Here's what Oliver Cowdrey Dunford said in 1889. His wife, the Osmonds, come down that line, by the way. But he basically says, we turned into Māori. They went native, as it were, as did many others, such as Matthew Cowley. This family of Māori, they were converted in 1884, and then they came up to Zion in 1894. The patriarch there couldn't even speak English, right? But they said, we need to come to Zion. One of the first Māori families. Others started going there and coming back too, but the church flourished, continues to flourish in New Zealand. We have these Book of Mormon labels. I'll just say this, whether you're Nephite or Lamanite, it's arbitrary. Again, it's situational. It's political, not ethnic. If you look at the Book of Mormon references there, the Nephites and Lamanites, sometimes in Jacob, they treated their families better than the Nephites. They were not filthy like the Nephites. Many were converted. They were steadfast in the truth. They took on a new name. It became Anti-Nephi Lehis. They took another name, People of Ammon. They were numbered among the Nephites, were numbered among the Lamanites at times. They were more righteous than the Nephites at times. They united with them and were called Nephites. The curse was taken off them when they were converted, is what they're saying. They became fair like Nephites. The Lamanite and Nephite name was abolished at another time in 4th Nephi 1. So there was no Manaavites, which is my point again. It's not based on ethnicity. It's actually political and arbitrary. And so I think, Māori, we're a fierce lot. We like Our political identity, our cultural identity, will fight to the death for it, and we have. With respect, that's including when any church tries to take our language and culture away. Right? And so whether Lamanite or Nephite, we say we are indigenous. We are members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and Māori, not all Māori. We are both, we can be both, and we flourish as both. And actually, as Matthew Cowley and others said, he actually said that our Māori ways in some ways are closer to the gospel. Right? Some of our indigenous ways. So there's a lot to learn from each other. We need to work more together so we can be indigenous. We can be, depending how you view it, Lamanite and Nephite. We just say we're good Latter-day Saints and Māori. So I'll finish here with whakatauki in our language, a proverb. I've got two proverbs actually. One is e kore au I ngaro he kakano e ruia mai I rangiatia. Rangiatia, we say, is where the dwelling place of God is. God dwells, and we say, I shall never be lost, for my seed or my genealogy goes back to God, no matter where we are, right, or what our genealogy, we all go back to God. And e taku mōkai wā poto noa koe ki Wanganui te wā, ku hipi ki te wā ki te tūmai. Somebody may have mentioned this earlier, but it's what that whakatauki says is, I'm but a speck in the moment of time situated between two eternities, the past and the future. As my current identity is significantly influenced by my past, by my tupuna, so the present success of my prosperity is influenced by my present and what I do. So I have a huge responsibility in relationship to my past and my present and my patriarchal blessing. I like to think I'm a great genealogist. My wife gets annoyed at it, but in our genealogy, we've done my Joseph line, which goes back to Wales, our French line, our Highlanders line, which goes back to Scotland. I've done all my Māori lines too, a lot of them, and knowing where they go all around the country. But my patriarchal blessing says no matter what your genealogy is, at the end of the day, you're a child of God. Right. Kia ora tātou. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank our presenters for those fascinating and thought-provoking presentations. How much time do we have?
What is this? We only have like 6 minutes.
Okay.
So maybe it's good to...
Well, this is the last session, right? If it's six minutes, you can walk out or we can keep going. I want to open it up to questions, but I want to pose a couple things that really stood out to me. That maybe we could address, and then we'll open it up, because I want to. Robert Joseph, you've made these really great points. Lamanite identity, Lehite identity, Book of Mormon, Israelite, indigenous identity is not ethnic, it's political, right? I was thinking about this earlier in the session, how the term culture also carries a lot of baggage that's often depoliticized. The term culture is something that anthropologists study, right? It's not something that has teeth in a courtroom often, right? The way that a political identity does. So I really love that point you make. It's situational, it's relational, right? It's always in relation to people it's going to be. So I wanted to call that out, Mara, think about can we think about Lamanite identity as a political identity? And how does doing that then affect our sense of what the political is? Right? Political is more than what candidates for office run for, but it's about the police, it's about the people. And so how is Lamanite identity a political identity? How can that expand our sense of what the political is to include religious identity, so-called ethnic identity, cultural identity, as being political, legal identities? As well, Farina, your point about accountability, I think, can be related here too. If Lamanite is a political identity, then what is our accountability in either representing other people as descendants of the people of the Book of Mormon, or articulating one's own identity, particularly when you're also representing other Maori people, other Hawaiian people, others who may not. Own that identity as well. What is the accountability? Who are we accountable to? And because we all have multiple accountabilities, can't please everyone, how do we prioritize those accountabilities? How do we live in communities when there are multiple competing accountabilities? And then finally, I think those are the most important ones, but I also want to address the issue. Sorry, I can't remember the term. Difraficismo. I don't think the academy is necessarily the most important arena in our lives, even if it gives me my paycheck and it gives us a lot of our paycheck, which is important. But part of what we do here is theorize, and that's not limited to the academy. In churches, we theorize about identity as well. But what does thinking about Lamanite identity bring to the academic theorizing of indigeneity? And indigeneity is, of course, not limited to the academic. It's also political, activist, has to do with treaty rights, et cetera, et cetera. So a few things to throw out.